to Western Contours Podcast, sharing experiences, providing insight, and looking for solutions to become better hunters. Whether you're chasing bugles over the next ridge, sitting a stand out east, this is about passion, pursuing our dreams of field, our lifestyle, the betterment of self and community, the enlightenment that comes from those moments spent in God's creation. Through these conversations, I hope you find insight, inspiration, education, and motivation to push beyond your limits. Live actual audio with my friend Renee Thornton. Welcome, ma'am. Good to see you. It's been a couple of nights. I get to see you in another week. Super excited about the conversation. I know down in Raton at the Hunt Fest, we had talked about doing it. And I don't know for the life of me what made me think I was going to pull 5 minutes, let alone enough time to record a podcast with as busy as we are during that event. So happy to sit down and have the conversation about you and Women Hunt and whatever else we can dive down into.
Right on. Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Absolutely. So we're just going to jump right in. Why don't we go for the little bit of an intro, let the folks know who you are and what you do, and then we'll go from there.
Sure. Yeah. So yes, I'm Renee Thornton and I live in Montana. I'm from Canada originally, but I married my husband in 2019 and relocated to the US. I became a US citizen in December, so I'm very, very proud and excited about that. But we live in Montana and I founded and run a program called Women Hunt. And there's quite a story behind all of that. But essentially, that's a program that I run with a volunteer committee. We're all volunteers. It's a program of the Wild Sheep Foundation. And that's how I get all of my good feelings and energy. And I just love it so much. And that's how I spend most of my time outside of, you know, my own personal interests.
So I like that, right? Is the good feelings and that positive energy. And for me, a lot of why I started the podcast was that reason, that motivation, right? Is to hear the stories and to kind of tug on people's, not so much their knowledge, but their inspirational stories, right? On being on the mountainside. So that's super cool. What spawned, because you're not a lifetime hunter, right?
Right.
What kind of spawned the walk down the path, if you will?
Yeah, sure. So I was born in the 70s in a small rural Alberta town. My folks were both raised in farming families. When they got married, they chose not to farm. But I lived in a small farming community outside of where, you know, I had access to my aunts and uncles' farms. I spent a lot of time there in my youth and really learned a lot about animal husbandry and, of course, grain farming, etc. But I got to tell you, and this is the God's honest truth, nobody ever talked about hunting in my extended family. And no, there was never any taxidermy on the walls. Wild game meat wasn't served. It just wasn't part of our farming family culture. So, but like I said, I grew up in this environment rurally and had a good understanding of, you know, farming practices. But anyway, I moved away to the big city of Edmonton after finishing school and started my life and my career, and I became really detached from all of that. And it was in my mid-30s where I started thinking about sourcing my meat more ethically. And so I started going to markets, farmers markets, where I could, you know, talk to local producers, small local producers, and make better choices about how I was getting my protein. And I can remember at about the same time I started thinking, what if I just learned how to hunt? Wouldn't that just be the best way to get my protein? You know, wild, free, unmolested animals, you know, natural, organic meat. But I didn't know anybody who did that. And it, you know, the thought absolutely overwhelmed me, Guy. And I actually, you know, it kind of made me, I was sort of afraid of the thought because I just didn't even know where to start with it. And so that thought kind of came and went for about a decade. And as I enter my 40s, it started to recur more often. And then by that time I had moved to the city of Calgary, and, you know, I had a really great profession. I worked my whole adult life for the federal government in Canada, and increasingly, you know, more responsible jobs. And the last half of my career, I was in upper level positions that were quite politically attached, and, you know, lots of like really long weeks, big hours. I was an executive. I managed a whole piece of our business in Calgary and Southern Alberta, and a lot of pressure, but really good job. But I came home one night in my mid-40s, and I can still remember this so clearly, sitting in my living room in downtown Calgary. with this glass of wine and thinking, I just feel exhausted and unfulfilled. And I just said, you have to change something. And you're the only person who's responsible for this and who can make that happen. And I thought, you know, you don't have to know how you're going to become a hunter. You just have to take the first step and apply those same principles you use in business, where you make difficult decisions every day, and you can do this. And so I went to bed that night. I woke up the next morning with an entirely refreshed focus and a real sense of surrender. And, you know, my surrender was all around not needing to control everything about this process and just taking that first step. So for me, as a Canadian at the time, my first step was figuring out how I became a legally law, you know, gun owner, a legal gun owner in Canada, radically different than in here in the United States. So that was my first hurdle, but I did that. And then I made the choice to join a whole bunch of local hunting clubs in the Calgary area. That also led me to joining the Alberta chapter of the Wild Sheep Foundation. So in Alberta, you know, we have the Rocky Mountains that come in from Alberta all the way down to Colorado, you know, and we have Rocky Mountain Bighorn sheep. I grew up around them. They're beautiful. I love them. They're my favorite wildlife species in North America. And so I joined that chapter and I really approached my journey and from a place of giving. And when I say that, what I mean is that I was going in cold, not knowing anybody, having no connections, completely on my own in my mid-40s. I was single at the time. I was divorced, you know, and I understood that for me anyway, my decision was to approach it by joining, becoming a member and showing up and saying, how can I help you? I'm a new hunter and I'm trying to get started. I want to meet some people, make some friends, learn, and I'm here to help. So that was the approach I used. And I get asked about that a lot, Guy. You know, a lot of women are intrigued by how I was able to just kind of do this all on my own. And it's a story, but you know, that was really a key fundamental part of it, was going in from a place of giving.
Let me interrupt you, because that's very, very important, right? And I think a lot of folks that come into what we do, the conservation side of it is always on a delay, right? And I feel like there's some of that has hurt us as hunters and has hurt conservation, as you ignore it, maybe not knowingly, right? So what was the thought process there? Why did that seem like something that you should be doing so early on? Because that is very, very atypical.
Yeah, well, it was less about really having a key focus on the conservation part of the conversation. I knew I needed to better understand that relationship. You know, I my motivation initially for wanting to hunt was to get my own protein, but I struggled with that concept of how does hunting help with wildlife conservation. So while that question was already in my mind, I knew that I wanted to learn about that and become informed and understand that relationship. My motivation for volunteering was just because that's an approach that's worked with me well throughout my life. I feel that if you go into anything, whether it's in a business environment or this scenario that we're talking about, if you go in asking with your hand out, you're going to be less well received than if you go in a giving position. So I just applied that principle. But you're right about the conservation conversation. And I can't tell you exactly why, other than I really was keenly interested in being able to answer the question that I was being asked by my family and my friends, who could not understand why I wanted to start hunting. And were asking me, isn't that contradictory? If you're killing animals, how are you a conservationist? And I didn't know how to properly answer the question. Right. And so for sure, it was in my mind. And, you know, that's probably the easiest way to explain it.
That's awesome. Okay, so I'm going to rewind some more, because you said some stuff and I was writing as you were going. So you mentioned, right, you started this thought process, if you will, in your early 30s, right? And sometimes we think of something and it just kind of dwindles out. Oh, I don't know how to get there, blah, blah, blah. But it stayed alive for over a decade, right? And then here you are when you finally got into the field and you were finally behind the trigger on that, say, that first animal. Did you feel there was more to it than just a desire to learn and harvest your own meat? Was it something that you felt was entwined? The way I explain it is, it's in my DNA. Like, there's always been this inkling, this itch to do it. And then when I finally was able to, you know, when I had the means and I figured it out, it was like, this is it. This is part of me. This is the calling. This is why I started with the curiosity. Did you find that? And the best way I could explain it is just that maybe that primal instinct, that something deep down inside of us.
Yeah, that's a great, you're the first person who's ever asked me that on all the podcasts I've done. So this, yes, to a degree. So, you know, we spend a lot of time in rural Alberta. And then, you know, with my family, we did a lot of camping, a lot of hiking, backpacking, snow skiing, water skiing. We had a lake lot, you know, that kind of stuff. Outside in nature wasn't foreign to me. And definitely, you know, anytime I spent outside, I always felt better, mm-hmm. right? And so, you know, that was where at the beginning of my journey, definitely, and I think maybe contributed to my ability to, in my mind, make this leap to hunting for my protein a little more easily than maybe others. It's because I already intrinsically felt those connections, right? But I will say, like, to your question about my first hunt, you know, it wasn't until I went out on my first hunt and I had to manage and process all the emotions behind that and then eventually be successful in harvesting my first animal, that is when it all went click for me. Mm-hmm. And those seeds of connectivity to my food that I was already thinking about and that connection to nature and the outdoors just went full circle. And it absolutely went click. And there was that fundamental realization, you know, I didn't immediately feel it the second I killed the animal. I was processing other things, but very shortly after, within a span of a few days, I was already there thinking, this is what we were built to do. Mm-hmm. This is 100% my DNA and all of our DNA, really. But yeah, that's kind of, so a little bit more circuitous than for you, but still the same result.
Right. And that's what's interesting to me, right? Is people will talk down to hunting, right? And it's, you try the explanation of, you know, that's what got our species to where we are today, right? But then I almost feel bad for people that you have this conversation with because they're missing that connection and connection to that part of your DNA, however you want to look at it, connection to your food, how whatever that means to the individual, but to see that missed and the beauty that is in the pursuit and the hunt and everything we do up to the table fair, it's like you are missing that and you have no idea how beautiful the pursuit is and how wonderful the experience is and the respect that you have for all life, right? And for me, the respect for life increased 1,000-fold. And I'm a big old teddy bear. You saw it. Like, I'm a big old teddy bear, right? I have my little, you know, my different personalities, if you will. But to have that come full circle and to feel life, to feel that full circle of life there's absolutely nothing more beautiful. And it sounds weird, right? Again, we're killing something and it's not an easy thing to grasp at any point, but your respect for that life just grows 1,000-fold, right? I never considered what that elk or deer is putting its head down to eat. Anytime before that, or wild hog, what triggered my hunting, I remember being out on Lake Kachuma, Central California, fishing with my uncle. I could remember it was probably a 1973, 74 tri-hull glass tron with, it was brown on top, kind of a tan on the bottom. And we're fishing bluegill in a cove, and I remember seeing the hogs eat on the side, and it just something that always stuck with me. I never considered what they were eating or what they were rooting until after I started hunting. And then all the grasses I see became more beautiful. That's life, right? How that animal taking that grass to the next 20 acres over, a mile over, how that perpetuates life in that cycle. And it's just an amazing, amazing thing to realize that and to see that grow, you know, through hunting. It's just a beautiful experience.
It is, you know, you're like, everything you've just said, there are like 20 different tentacles we could go down and Absolutely. Explore and everything you've just said. And I, you know, I am always amazed. So I'm going to choose this tentacle But I'm always amazed at how so many people like to pigeonhole hunters into one little slot. And, you know, I think it's such a disservice to any group in society, because the simple fact of the matter is we all know that in every walk of life, there's a percentage of the demographic that are jerks, and the majority are wonderful people, you know, and for some reason, hunters just get lambasted with this brush that we're all these horrible people, right? And I personally think that, like anything else, the more effort you put into something, the more value you place on it, right? So follow this thinking. You can just go to the store. Now, this only applies if you eat meat. This doesn't apply to the vegetarian or to the
vegan.
What's the word? The vegans. Thank you. Right. So we'll just back them out of the conversation for a minute, because if you don't eat meat, then it doesn't apply. But if you're a meat eater and you go to the store to buy your protein, you haven't worked for that protein, you're paying for it, and that's your investment, right? But you haven't raised it, you haven't cared for it, you haven't slaughtered it, you haven't butchered it, you haven't, you know, all you've done is paid the money to buy it. Your investment is very low. When you make the choice to hunt for your protein, you know what's involved as a hunter. I mean, it is the work that has to go in to your training, research, your monetary investment in your equipment, your time and training, all of it. I mean, when you put that much work into sourcing your own food, the value explodes exponentially that you place on it. And that is such an important part of the conversation to why we value those animals so much. And it, you know, if we can help people understand that little thread, which seems minor, but it's really significant, you know, it's like anything else. If you just give somebody something, they don't value it as much as if they have to earn it themselves. It's a part of that conversation for sure.
Yeah, that's the lack of investment, we'll say, right? And going and buying, and here's the cliche, cellophane and foam meat from the store, and then to be judgmental on what we do, it drives me crazy. That's a topic for another time. I'll rant off of the podcast. So, you know, one of the things that I find inspirational in your story is that, and not to say 40, you know, mid 40s is old, by no stretch of the imagination is it, but to be a single woman, solo hunter, I'm making an assumption there, in your 40s, starting out and saying, I'm going to do this. What did that, and this is the inspiration part, folks, what did that barrier of entry look like, and what part of it was the most daunting for you?
Oh, wow. Yeah. You know, I think I understood on some level that there would be raised eyebrows about my decision, you know, without really knowing why, other than hunting always seemed to be a male-dominated thing to me. And I've since learned that it is, and it still is, even though women are the fastest or one of the fastest growing demographics, it's still heavily male. You know, so I figured, how might I be received out there, you know, showing up at 46 years old on my own? And so that intimidated me for sure. And some of the barriers that I faced, so that was kind of an internal barrier, Guy, I would suggest, you know, nervousness I had, right?
Which sometimes is the biggest hurdle that you have to jump over, right?
Yeah, for sure. Now, I'm a pretty confident individual, so I'm lucky that I'm able to walk into rooms where I don't know anybody, and I'm okay with that. You know, I can walk up and introduce myself, and I'm good with that. And I would say some of my largest barriers, that first 12 to 18 months, was, so actually, you know what, I'm just going to pause there for a second. I will answer your question, but I really want to impress on everybody, but that my journey was largely positive. The community is very welcoming. It's really important to note that, you know, most of my interactions were really, really positive. Most people were really excited and interested to learn. And you have to remember, this was back in early 2017. Even in the short span of time since then, the number of women involved today in 2024 versus 2017 is astronomically higher. So it was a different landscape back then. But my biggest challenges were definitely the skepticism I faced from some people. You know, what were my motivations? Why are you here? Why are you really here? Was sometimes the question I would get. Having to sort of just keep keep my focus straight on my goal and showing up and volunteering and being there to help support these organizations was something I was completely willing to do. But, you know, after a while, it was almost a little bit like tiring, you know, like, wow, I can't believe I still have to prove myself. Obviously, I'm here for the right reasons. But so kind of getting over that little hump of skepticism was something that was challenging. There were definitely, you know, some women who, this surprised me, Guy. I wasn't expecting to get some resistance from the women that were in the community, but definitely there were some women who were not the most welcoming, you know, and it's hard to know what motivations are behind that. Maybe just, you know, uncertainty about, I don't know what to say. No, I'm not sure.
That
it surprised me.
Yeah. Heard that before,
yeah,
where that was one of the biggest challenges, you know, to kind of break through that, which is, it's pretty interesting. My wife has some opinions about that one.
and then, you know, yeah. And there were a couple of jerks out there who, you know, said not nice things or made, you know, offers that are not, you know, that not repeatable here, you know. But that was absolutely the minority. But there were a couple of interactions that were nasty enough that twice in that first year, I almost threw in the hat. But I'm tenacious. And I understood that this was a sliver of representation of the community and it wasn't my overall experience. But, you know, there was somebody who's now an excellent friend of mine who, it was really interesting. It was about 14 months in and we were at an event and he actually said to me, he said, "You know what? You've really proven yourself this last year, and I now believe you that you're the real deal." And it was nice to hear, but I was like, "Wow, I can't believe! Like, why do I even have to prove myself like that?" You know, it's an interesting thing to hear. So, you know, when I think about my first 12 to 18 months, I really think about what needs to shift and what can shift or what should shift to just make that a little bit more welcoming.
Yeah. And that was one of the things I was thinking about. We want people in the fold, right? We want to see this continue. And if we have people that are trying to come in that are shunned, I mean, you see it in like, you know, you hear it all the time too, Facebook groups where people are just getting lambasted for asking questions. And it's crazy to me. Some of them, I'm like, good Lord. And I'll send them a message and I'm like, "Hey, I'm sorry you're getting that, if I could help in any way." But you would think that we would be more inviting. And I don't know if that's a different landscape in Canada as you're going through that, you know, versus here, but it doesn't make any sense to me considering where we are as hunters and why we choose to behave that way in some instances. Strange.
You know, it's a good question, but I think there's a few things in there. I learned really quickly that hunters are a very tight community and it's very much a relationship. It's an activity about relationships almost more than anything else, right? People love to go hunting with their friends or with their family and it's very personal. And so, you know, I learned really quickly that hunters like to hunt with their group and also that hunters are very protective about where they hunt and for really valid reasons. You know, if you're hunting on private land, that means you've worked really hard to establish a relationship with the landowner and you're protective of that for really good reasons. I totally understand that.
But that's no excuse for me to shun you and make you prove yourself for a year and a half.
No, fair enough. But I think I'm just kind of exploring kind of the psychology, right? Like, you know, and if you're a public land hunter, you're also equally protective because you're competing on an ever more pressured landscape, right? And I think sometimes those two things drive resistance to taking people out. So they might be welcoming of you and excited that you're there and willing to answer questions and help you with gear and whatever else. But when it comes to taking you out in the field, that was certainly my biggest challenge, was getting somebody to take me out into the field. And I think those two things are primary motivators. Now, I'm not suggesting that people don't take people out. They do. It's just that they're really careful, really selective. Right. And I think that's why it takes that time to kind of prove yourself, is because they're like, "Okay, you're the real deal. Now I'm willing to take you out. Now I'm going to show you my secret spot." or introduce you to that landowner. Mm-hmm. That's what I was getting at.
I got you. So how did you, as you were going through this, right, we have to kind of reconcile the killing part of it. How did you mm-hmm. do that? What was your thought on that? Like, wow, can I actually do this as yeah. you're working through that?
For sure. So I'm going to tell you that I had three key concerns going into this journey. And these concerns are what I most often hear from all the women that I meet and talk to and help out along the way. And the first one was the fear of the firearm. I was afraid of firearms, you know, so it was overcoming that fear, getting training, using it, becoming comfortable with firearm and optics. The second one was a terror that I felt at wounding or making an animal suffer. So those were my two top preoccupations. And then the third one was very personal, and it was all about how would I feel when I took an animal's life. I'd never taken an animal's life ever. And in any way, not even hitting one in a car, it never happened to me. Right. So those were my things. So, you know, for me, when I went out on my first hunt with my first hunting mentor, he and his wife owned a couple of sections of land in Alberta. He was able to take me out and train me on a bolt action rifle with a simple scope, no ballistic turrets. He got me out to 200 yards, very comfortably shooting to 200 yards with that setup. I felt, you know, nervous about using my firearm in the field, but I understood that I was capable of making that shot, right? So that was really good. I had that ahead of time. You know, when we were in the moment when I was preparing to take the shot, he did an excellent job of mentoring me. You know, he was really, really calm. Very calm person, spoke really quietly into my ear, and he actually had me explain where I was going to place the shot. So that helped calm me down, because then that helped my second concern, wounding the animal, right, or making them suffer. He reminded me that I knew how to make the shot. The animal was at about 108 yards. He reminded me that I was able to do this to 200. That calmed me down. Then he asked me to tell him where I was going to place the shot. I told him. That calmed me down about wounding, because I was like, okay, I know where I need to take that shot to make sure the animal doesn't suffer, right? And then the third one was all for me. And I didn't know until I took that shot and harvested that animal how I would react. And so I was, you know, scared about how I would feel about killing an animal. Really scared, actually. But, you know, I'm grateful that I was able to reconcile all those ranges of emotions that I felt in that moment and in the, you know, the short span afterwards, and understand that I was comfortable with it. And not only that, I was also like, I love this.
So what was that? Yeah. What was that first animal at 108?
Yeah, it was a black bear. Completely untraditional first hunt. Right. I know I thought I was going to be going for a white-tailed doe, you know, in November, and he called me up and February, I think, and said, are you ready to get hunting? And I said, yeah, what are we planning? A November hunt for whitetail doe? And he's like, no, we're going to go hunt spring black bear. And he said, I was speechless, but he had been, you know, he'd been hunting bear in this area of Northern Alberta for over 20 years. He had a bear camp up there. And actually, in retrospect, I'm so grateful that was my first hunt, because I think black bear is actually a really great first species for new hunters to get out and hunt. It's a really fun, I mean, I did it on spot and stalk. That's my experience. I've only done bear hunting on spot and stalk. So, you know, you're out walking around, you're able to observe the bears and their behavior. You get a lot of time to be taught if you have a great mentor like I did. You know, when we went out the first weekend, we saw 17 bears. We did not take a single shot, because while they were all legal, my mentor did a great job of teaching me the principles of going for old boars and the reason why, you know, we take out their genetics, because we want younger boars to be the breeding boars. And also a lot of people don't know this, but old boars will kill younger boars or cubs, right, to remove their competition. So, you know, that was a really great lesson for me. 3 days of hunting hard for bear, seeing 17 bears and not taking a single shot, because he was teaching me those really important principles about selective harvest, right? That's and Yeah. And then also, you know, bear hunting, I think, is a great first hunt. Also, only because, you know, if you're on spot and stalk, you have a lot of time to set up your shot. So if you're a brand new hunter, you're not dealing with a skittish deer who might be taken off. You're dealing with an animal that's calmer or moving more slowly. And it gives you as the new hunter that opportunity to control your breathing and get yourself in a position and have the opportunity to have a mentor talk you through some of those doubts in your mind, right?
What did you think of that when he called you, right? In terms of the meat you thought you were going to be eating versus bear, right? Because a lot of people go bear or mountain lion. Like, what do you mean you can eat that?
Yeah. The great question. I did ask him that. I said, do you eat bear meat, Don? And he said, oh yeah, it's delicious. And I said, okay, I trust you. Like, if you're telling me it's good, it must be good, you know? And it was delicious. I really enjoy bear meat. It's one of my favorites. But I definitely had that question in my mind. You know, can you eat predator meat?
Right.
Yes, you can.
Yeah.
And it's real good. Yeah.
Really good.
Mountain lion's really good too.
I'm going to just throw something out there, right? And you were talking about it, and I just want people to hear it. And if somebody that doesn't hunt happens to hear this, is you said that you were never responsible for killing an animal. And I think that is a lot of what we see with the foam and cellophane, is people think that they have no part in killing that animal. But you go to the grocery store, you need to redirect your thought on killing. It's indirectly, you're paying someone to do it. But yes, you have a hand in killing what you're buying at the store, just as we do if we're out in the field, you know, taking our own meat. So
it's a great point, Guy.
Yeah,
that's a really good way to look at it.
I'll get in conversations with people, right? Somebody will look at me kind of funny if I'm, you know, I'll come off the mountain like I did last week. The wife's gone, so I'm struggle bussing, and I run to the store to get something easy to cook for dinner for me and the dogs. And, you know, I get this kind of strange look, which always puzzles me. I live in the freaking mountains and we're surrounded by hunters, and I get this look like, what are you doing? You know, yeah, I'm out hunting. What you got in your basket there? You know, and they have one of the bagged broasted or roasted chickens from the store, you know, and I like, same thing. And the lady looks at me and I go, it's exactly the same thing. I'm just getting mine on my own. And she kind of looked at me and did that. Eyebrows went up and she says, have a nice day. And I'm like, all right, point taken. Ooh, we're good here. And it's just funny to me that we think that we have no part in it, you know, and you said, pull the vegans and the vegetarians out of it, right? Cliche, or, you know, something somebody said a million times, you kill more that's in the ground than we do, you know, as we're out on the landscape hunting. So I think everyone has a part in it. It's just having that realization and being honest about, you know, our part in the killing, farm raised or otherwise.
Yep.
So let's talk about, so how did all this turn into you being the chair of Women Hunt, which is a phenomenal program? And then we'll just parlay into what Women Hunt does and the opportunity that it's providing.
Yeah, thanks. There's a direct correlation between my journey and the creation of Women Hunt. And so I was living in Calgary, as I mentioned, and I also loved to fly fish. And every summer I would travel from Calgary to Libby, Montana in the northwest corner. It's on the Kootenai River. It's this beautiful tailwater, excellent trout fishery. And I would book there with my favorite fly fishing guide. I'm just going to tell you guys, his name is Dave Blackburn with Kootenai Anglers. And he's awesome. If you ever get up to northwestern Montana and you want to fish with somebody great, he's the guy. But anyway, and every summer I would book 3 days of fishing with him and head down there. And it was like a little mini holiday for me. And so it was the summer of 2018. And I had gone to my first sheep show in January. I went there on my own. I flew down to Reno. The sheep show, I'm sorry, I should just add, is the Wild Sheep Foundation's annual expo and banquets. And they have, like, much like Dallas Safari Club or SEI has annual national banquets, so does the Wild Sheep Foundation. And I'm explaining this because there's a tie. So I had gone down to the Wild Sheep Foundation on my own, bought my conference package, booked my hotel, my flight, went down and ended up meeting all sorts of new people who are still to this day some of my best friends, and had a great experience. So that was my first exposure to the Wild Sheep Foundation. I had mentioned earlier that I had joined the Alberta chapter, but this is the national branch. And so why that's relevant is because I was planning my summer holidays and I had gone onto their website. and saw that they were having an open house in Bozeman in July. And Libby to Bozeman is, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 hour drive, a bit of a stretch. And I thought, well, I'm going to be in Montana at the same time. I wonder if that's worth driving half a day down. And so I called up their vice president of conservation, who I had met in Alberta earlier that year at an event. And I said, hey, I don't know if you remember me, Renee Halloon from Calgary. And he's like, oh, yeah, the new hunter. And I said, yeah. And I asked him, is it worth the trip? And he said, it sure is. It's a great party. 300-400 people come out. They have a band and beer and barbecue, and you'll meet a whole bunch of folks. So I said, okay, I'll come down if I can get a campsite, because I was tenting. And I said, and put me to work. I'll volunteer at the open house. And so I got added to the volunteer roster, and I showed up and was introduced to all the staff, including the CEO, Gray Thornton, and all the staff about my volunteer orientation and selling raffle tickets. And I meet this man named Brett Jefferson. And he was the chairman of the board of directors at the time. He's past chair now. And we had never met before. And he was really interested to hear more about what my first year or so on my own was like. So we got the chance to sit down and really get into a lot of details about it. And unbeknownst to me, he reached out to the CEO, Gray Thornton, and said, hey, did you get a chance to meet that girl, Renee, from Calgary? And he said, yeah, I was briefly introduced to her. And he said, well, I had a chance to talk to her at length. And I want you to sit down and talk to her, because I think it's time for the Wild Sheep Foundation to step up and develop a women's program. And I think she's the one to do it. And so Gray reached out to me and asked if I was still in the area. And I was fly fishing and hiking in the Bozeman area for a few extra days. And so I was able to meet with him and tell him my story firsthand. And then I went back home to Alberta to my life and my job. And a few days later received an email from Brett and officially inviting me to consider creating a program. So that was the genesis of the creation of Women Hunt, was my chance opportunity at meeting the chairman and having this conversation. And then he and the CEO deciding that the Wild Sheep Foundation wanted to do
something. So that, well, wait, let's be real. Cause that was twofold there, right? That's when Gray was like, oh yeah, she's a bad one.
Well, apparently, but I do want to be clear here. I had never met him before, and we were not dating at this point, but yeah. We did start dating after that.
That's funny. Oh, and honestly, like, you know, and this is a freaking tangent. This is just my head, right? When we got on for Sheep Fever and the dynamic between you two, I would have thought you were together 40 freaking years, right? You guys just have there's just something about you two together. And that was over Zoom. So I can't imagine what it feels like when you're in the room together. So that's super cool, right? And I love to see that connection. But I just don't think you don't see strong connections like that a lot anymore. It was definitely obvious
to me.
So shout out to good old Gray there. I still got a picture of you, buddy. I just deleted that off my phone. I don't have it anymore. I laughed about it. I saw the terror in your eyes when I told him I was going to share it. Yeah. So tangent there on my part. So that just spawned it. So what did you think when they presented that to you?
Oh my gosh. I had no idea what those two were cooking up, and that email hit my inbox and I was shaking. I remember that I was just a year and a half in, and I really consider myself to be just a small town Alberta girl, you know, and I really like a nobody, right? You know, and if you know what I mean.
Right.
Like,
oh, absolutely.
And I was just, I was shaking. I was both like really excited and overwhelmed and a bit confused. Like, why me? You know, kind of that question. Like, why would they ask me to do this?
But then that starts a journey all over that you literally just got your ankles wet. Right.
I know. I had one hunt under my belt, you know, and more in the plans. I had a couple of hunts that I ended up doing the fall of 2018, but I only had myself one hunt in the books. But you know, when we talk about that that journey that hunters go through, mm-hmm. you know, the seven steps of hunting or six steps of hunting that hunter education teaches you. You're right. Like I kind of let to did that final stage of, you know, doing things for others really quickly while still exploring those steps for myself in between. Right. Well,
that goes right back to what you were saying about the giving part of it. Right. And maybe there was a lot of wisdom in them saying that this is the lady, right? Because I think when we're fresh into something, we don't lose sight of the struggle. Right. So having that fresh in your mind, there's some wisdom in that. But then also the aspect of you just giving through the entire process, that doesn't go unseen, I think, for most people that really are really looking at it, you know?
Right. That's a good point. Yeah.
So where are we at with the Women Hunt program? What does the Women Hunt program offer? How do people get involved and who can be involved?
Yeah. Great question. So, you know, we're still a pretty young program, even though that was back in 2018. I'll be honest with you, at first, really uncertain about what we would do. So the first thing I did was I formed a committee of volunteers. They're all women from across the United States and Canada. And then the Sheep Show of 2019, we had a seminar, really well attended, close to 100 people, a mix of men and women. And it was an opportunity to introduce the program to the community and the members of the committee and do a little bit of Q&A. And then we did another one where we actually structured it like a town hall. And for 90 minutes, we just had the crowd feed us what they wanted. And that was early 2020 when we did that. And still trying to figure out direction, right? That's why we chose to do that kind of open house sort of feel, town hall feel. And then got immediately hit with COVID. Everything came to a screeching halt. There was no movement on anything. And then when we ramped up in 2021, that's when I really consider the program to have launched, was in the fall of 2021. So I just want to kind of provide people that perspective about why I say we're a fairly young program. But, you know, essentially our whole goal is to engage with, educate, empower, and inspire women. And what we really want to do is help more women cross barriers into the hunting and conservation landscapes, right? And so essentially, we just are interested in creating space and opportunity for women who are curious. We also create that space for women who are already in the community, you know, and just want to have more of a connection with other like-minded women. Really important to say, though, that that's not at the exclusion of men, right? I have, from the very beginning, made it really clear to the committee and to anybody we touch that it's not at the exclusion of men. I really value the men in my life. And all of my mentors have been men, by the way. I've never had a female mentor in the field. And, you know, it's not at the exclusion of. Men are part of our journeys. They're critically important. They elevate us. They support us, just like we do for them, right? So we are a community for women, for sure. We're creating space for women, but we have a lot of men that are part of that community, and they're right behind us helping those women. So, you know, I really like people to know that. And so some of the things we do right now is we have an annual opportunity to go on an absolutely exceptional skills-based training program. We partnered with the FTW Ranch in Hill Country of Texas. That was a business I was introduced to at that first sheep show I went to in January 2018. And my reason for going to their booth was because I realized that as a woman in my late 40s, I needed to learn how to shoot well quickly. I didn't have a lifetime to learn and practice, right? And so they do a lot of their business model at their ranch is primarily rifle training. And I'm simplifying their business model big time here, but they have about a 12 or 14,000 acre ranch. They do have whitetail and exotic species on the ranch. There are hunting opportunities there, but what they primarily do is a firearms training, and they do it for civilian and military and corporate organizations, you know, Ruger or whoever, Hornady. But they have this whole suite of training programs for civilians. And so I bought one of their packages and went and had a 4-day precision rifle course, and it was a complete game changer. It just took me, would have taken me 20 years to learn what I learned in 4 days, right? So All I'm saying is that they had developed a new hunter course, and the owner of the ranch knew that I was interested in starting some sort of skills-based training through my program without having to actually develop the program. None of us that serve on this community committee are experts and qualified to train, right? So we were looking for somebody to partner with. So women have an opportunity to apply, and actually that application process is going to open really soon for this year. But my committee and I developed an application process. It's available online, and any woman over the age of 21 can apply. Right now, this is restricted to 21 and over because we ask people not to bring anybody with them to the ranch so that they're not distracted and can concentrate on the instructors and what they're learning. And so because there are firearms there and a bar, you have to be 21 or older right now for this offering. So any woman over the age of 21 can apply. And then we assess those applications. We ask some really great challenging questions. We have a scoring rubric to make sure that we assess everybody equitably. And we do a blind assessment. So their identifiers are removed. So if their names are removed, if they say how old they are in their application, it's removed. If they identify anything else that might bias us, maybe, you know, I don't know, everybody has subconscious and conscious biases. So those get removed so that we're assessing blind. And then we go through that assessment process, and then we decide who the qualifying women are. And then we find out who they are and where they're from and a little bit about them. And it's a big reveal. It's really exciting, actually. But they get a chance to go down to the ranch and take part in a 4.5-day soup to nuts, fully comprehensive learn to hunt program. It's now been called, they've rebranded, it's called Field to Fork, but it's a program designed for new hunters. And so you don't ever have had to touch a firearm in your life. It doesn't matter if you've never even handled one. In 4.5 days, they will take you from zero experience to being able to understand your firearm, the components, cleaning, your optics, shooting positions. They'll have you shooting accurately and consistently to 300 yards, guaranteed. And then I've never seen anybody not being able to do that. And I've been multiple times. Like when I say guarantee, I say that a little bit like tongue in cheek because I don't work for the ranch, but I mean, I've never seen anybody not be able to do it. And then they get you out hunting. You get 4 opportunities to hunt. The ranch determines where they need help with their management plan, but it's typically white-tailed doe. Sometimes they're able to open it up to axis or fallow doe and occasionally to maybe some spike bucks that they need management help with, but that's decided by the ranch on spot. And you get 4 opportunities to hunt. They teach you different hunting techniques, spot and stalk, using blinds, you know, et cetera, different techniques. You're taught how to field dress. You're taught how to butcher. They bring in a chef from San Antonio, Chef Josh, with Gastronomy Outdoors. He specializes in wild game preparation. He teaches the women how to prepare wild game in interesting and creative ways. And so really, and they do this all in 4.5 days. Wow. It's extraordinary what happens. And so that's really what I call our flagship offering. And you know, there's some exciting things about that. You know, it's very competitive. There's hundreds of applicants. We choose 12 women. It's highly competitive, but for the women who get chosen, it's free. All they have to do is fly down to San Antonio, Texas, and we take it from there. We have such generous donors and sponsors who take care of this program that we're able to offer that to these women.
That's awesome.
We have donors who give them Sitka gear, gives them, you know, head to toe camel package, Kenetrek boots, generously donates a pair of boots for every woman to get started with, Boyd harness, you know, rifle case, duffel bags, that kind of stuff. We have great sponsors. And so the women get this unbelievable training opportunity. Skills training opportunity and a bunch of gear to get them started for the cost of a flight to San Antonio. It's incredible.
That's amazing. How much inspiration do you gather over and over from those 12 women going, is it once per year, twice per year? How many times?
Yeah, right now we're at once per year. Yes. And you know, maybe a little later on we can talk about where we're going with the program, but right now it's once a year, but I get so much inspiration out of it. It's so fulfilling for me. It just fills my cup all the time. And you know, what some of the things we do a little bit differently with our program too is, you know, I call it the three prongs. So for prong one is the course, right? What I just described to all your listeners. The second prong is that when the women come out of the course, we set them up with a mentor. And we do that through the chapters and affiliates of the Wild Sheep Foundation. They're found all over the country. And we work with them to get a mentor, to find a mentor, a suitable mentor for all of these women, like for whichever state or province they live in. That was so important to me when I developed this concept, because mentorship is so key. You know, if you don't have somebody there to help you along and lift you up when maybe you're struggling on, you know, and have a setback, you can really derail quickly from being super engaged and you fall right off the boat, right?
So, oh, yeah. That happens to season hunters season after season after season. So that's huge.
It's huge. And so that's the second prong. And, you know, our chapter and affiliate network is so awesome. You know, the 12 women who are chosen, we approach the CNA closest to wherever they live and ask them to sponsor the woman and sponsor, you know, they help financially contribute to offset the cost of that experience for the women. They also help find a mentor, and then they're asked to give a free 1-year membership to their chapter and affiliate. And that creates instant community for these women, right? And then, you know, they have events they can go to and meet people and get involved. So, you know, big shout out to our CNAs. But, and then the third prong is fully comes from my approach to going in from a position of giving. So the third prong is called giving back. And this is a requirement of the program. The women sign off on a number of agreements when they apply. So they acknowledge that they understand all these agreements before we'll even look at their application. And there are a number of agreements that talk about the opportunity they're being given through these generous sponsors and donors, and how they're required to give back. And we ask them to give back in a few different ways and to a few different areas. So it's certainly to the Wild Sheep Foundation and the Wild Sheep Resource, to Women Hunt, our program, to the chapters and affiliates. And then we challenge them to think about how they might give back in their own communities and what that might look like. And they're all of you can appreciate very different women, you know, introverts, extroverts, educated, et cetera, like whatever. They're all over the map. They have different interests, different skill sets. So it looks different for all of them, but they are asked to give back in some capacity in the wildlife conservation realm, right? So some of them are educators and they're introducing these concepts in the classroom, which is phenomenal. You know, some of them are creating their own skills-based programs or women's groups, or they're bringing in kids. You know, some of them are really, really dedicated to the North American model of wildlife conservation, which is part of our training curriculum. We offer that. We don't offer it. We deliver it right before they go to Texas so that they have a basic understanding of the 7 principles of the North American model, so that they have the ability to, you know, at least start a conversation to help people understand that relationship between hunting and conservation, right? So some of them are super passionate about that, and they're leading the charge down that path, whether it's on podcasts or writing articles or engaging with legislators. You know, we had a lobbyist that came through our 2022 class. She works for the Oregon Professional Hunters Association. She testifies in front of legislature in Oregon constantly, right? So, you know, we have some real heavy hitters out there that are doing phenomenal things. And this is what I think is the most exciting part of our program, is that outreach that they have. All the tentacles now, the hundreds of lives that they're touching, that is now thousands of lives, mm-hmm. and the impact that they're having. And it's really that grassroots, you know, viral impact that is phenomenal. And that I'm really, really proud of.
Heck yeah.
And proud of those women. Yeah.
I mean, again, inspirational, right? I mean, that is so important. And then to be able, I hate using the terminology because it's used in places that I don't like, but I have to say it, that's one of the biggest challenges, I think, when I've talked to women, is that space that you said. I don't have to say the other part of that. That space that makes them feel comfortable, right? And for some, that's having more women around or having women instructors that makes it easier, that's less daunting or fearful as they approach something that is daunting and full of fears and concerns. So to have that community built around them before they even step into it is huge, huge, huge.
Yeah.
The one thing I say you need to add to the Women Hunt program is the understanding of packing out. So for the folks listening, right, and most already know that listen to the podcast, Wild Sheep Foundation is the title sponsor for Western Hunt Fest, and the Women Hunt program is the title for our women's events, be it our women's archery, our women's pack out challenge, our women's elk calling. It was important for Jeff Efren and I to uphold the tenets of, you know, that growing demographic and supporting the women in our lives by putting that at the forefront of Western Hunt Fest. So Women Hunt and Wild Sheep Foundation, of course, are at the events, and we decided, you know, or she decided that she wanted to try the pack out challenge. And Devin said, well, let's go. And we went, and I went on her first loop with her for the pack out challenge. So, you know, it's a simulated mule deer. And she was like, oh my goodness. I think she finished in what, December or something like that with the program?
November.
Yeah. And I was like, yeah, this is an important part of that resource. Once you pull the trigger, it becomes a resource, and this is how it gets off the mountain. And it's not everybody's experience, but for us, that's important, right? Is for people to understand, educate themselves on what they're capable of, and plan that into their hunt especially when we start talking about miles, right? Public land miles, inaccessible by vehicle at times. But it was so, I'm using the word again, it was so inspirational for me to see the light come on in her head as she went through the pack out challenge, but then to muster up everything she had to, and then understand, you know, this is what it's going to be like if you pull that trigger in the mountains, and to have the conversation, as much conversation as we can with the hard breathing and the sweating, as she had over half a mule deer on her back, was just flipping awesome. And I said, well, did you guys talk about this? She goes, no. And I go, well, this is a huge part of that. And she was like, oof. But it was so cool to be a part of, right, and understand her journey and where she was at and have that conversation as we're doing it.
Yeah.
You know, to be a new hunter and to have that realization and kind of take it away, you know, in the pack out challenge, yes, you can do this, right? And to see her come across, I mean, just beaten, just absolute beaten. I ran out when I saw her come around that last bend, so maybe her last 300 yards. And I ran out there and she goes, 10 steps, I got to pause. And she'd take 10 and she'd pause. And I'm like, it's your pace. It's your pack out. Keep it going at your pace. And it was just flipping awesome to see that. So it was, yeah, I was totally digging it.
She did great.
And really what it did too is it enlightened me on what the Women Hunt program does, right? Because as much as I knew, there was so much that I didn't know, but then to have the conversation with someone who basically just went through it and understand where she was at and why she did it, you know, and the fact that it was part of her journey as a wife, right? With her husband being a hunter. So it was just super cool, super, super cool. So you talked about the application period for this year's Field to Fork.
Right.
When does that open? When does it close?
Yeah. So it'll be open from May 1st to 31st. And it's an online application. It'll be on our website. So that's wildsheepfoundation.org/womenhunt. Or if you want to keep it a little more simple, you just go to wildsheepfoundation.org and then there's a drop down menu under Hunt and you'll see Women Hunt there and it's there. So May 1st to 31st. And the course dates this year for those who are fortunate enough to be chosen will be November 8th to 13th.
Okay. I'll include that in the show notes for people that know someone or are interested in applying for that. So you talked about the future of Women Hunt. Since we know what Women Hunt does now, what is in the future? How can you make that any better than it already is?
Yeah, well, for sure. Offering more opportunity to more people. That's, you know, number one. So we're going to be expanding our number of offerings and to larger groups. So the flagship course that I described, depending on the capacity of our volunteer committee, we may be able to do it a couple of times a year instead of just once. But when I talk about expansion, I think beyond that, right? And so it may not look like that whole soup to nuts experience, but I certainly see the value in just doing more activities and more locations for larger groups of women. So maybe it's a two-day instructional on wild game cooking, or maybe it's day at the range, or maybe, you know, whatever it can be. We can also parcel pieces of skills training out, partner with those people who already delivered in an excellent manner, and then just do it in more areas and provide that opportunity. You know, I'd love to see like first 50 women who sign up for 2-day rifle instructional at the Whittington Center in Raton or whatever. You know, I'm just saying that because we were just there, but it could be pretty much anywhere. So definitely expansion and larger groups of women, including young women. So, you know, unfortunately, for the reasons I just explained, this particular course is for 21 and up, but we definitely want to engage with younger women too, right? So that would look a little different and be something different, but that's okay too. So definitely expansion for youth, young women. We're working on really improving our website. Our website right now is quite basic, but I've been working on gathering resources to develop content on the website that is designed strictly to help people who are looking for information. So one of the things I found back in late 2016, 2017 was, you know, I do these Google searches and not knowing anything, I didn't know what was reputable. I didn't know what I could trust. So, you know, we're going to build a platform that allows a person, and you could be a man or a woman, or, you know, there's no gender bias if you're on the internet, right? Anybody could say, I live in the state of Wyoming, click Wyoming, and then we'll have vetted resources there. So people know, oh, I could go here for this or go there for that. We're working on that. It's a big lift, but so it's going to take some time, but we're working on that. We're going to, on our website, we're going to have a section dedicated to the stories of the women who are giving back so that people can really get inspired. I think it's super important, mm-hmm. you know, and also learn about what they're doing and maybe get involved, you know, if they're in that woman's area. We're going to have a culinary area. So Chef Josh that I mentioned is now the executive chef for the Wild Sheep Foundation and Women Hunt. So we're going to work with Chef on doing a culinary corner with him on our website, you know, and other types of content around conservation. So that's a really key part, right? It's the conservation. We started this whole podcast started off with that comment from you. So we're going to have like a conservation corner where we'll have suggestions for how people can get involved, you know, certainly within the wild sheep community for people who love wild sheep, but also beyond, you know, we love our national partners. You know, I have a great relationship with NWTF, you know, we do with DSC and SCI and other partners. There's great people out there doing great stuff. And if we can help point people to their conservation projects, because all nonprofits always look for volunteers, right? Absolutely. So we can help point then, you know, that'll be great. So we're doing that. We're going to start offering paid opportunities. So we're actually launching one right away. I'm going to be down at FTW May 3rd to 8th. And we're testing an industry-based delivery of Field of Fork for Women Hunt. So when I say industry-based, I mean women who work in the hunting, conservation, outdoor fields who don't hunt but want to. And a lot of the women were taking this time out, their employer is paying for their opportunity because they work for an employer in the hunting world, but they don't hunt. It's great staff development, right? Training development. So we're doing this paid industry-focused delivery. I've received feedback from some of the members of the Wild Sheep Foundation who are of an economic demographic, higher economic demographic. And, you know, they have an interest in paying for the opportunity and as opposed to competing for it. You know, they have the means, but they still want to be able to have that community of women around them. So we're working on that. committee really excited. One of our committee members recently suggested that we should develop a scholarship program, and we will. I don't know exactly what that's going to look like yet. It's early discussion, but we're going to develop a scholarship stream. And then one of the things we're going to launch this year is it's all around a dedicated legacy fund for women who've survived trauma. And so the story behind that guy is really impactful for me personally, and then for our Wild Sheep community, because a member of our community, Derek Blake, and his wife, Ruby, were married a few years ago. Gray and I were actually at their wedding. They're from Alaska. And they have a baby girl. Her name is Harbor. And really tragically, last year, Ruby died in a sudden accident. And Derek was, you know, became a widower abruptly as a newlywed with this young baby. And it just rocked our whole world. You know, Ruby was a really beautiful, and when I say beautiful, I mean like across the spectrum, mm-hmm. just this bright, wonderful, funny, talented woman. And her death was such a shock. But she had a story of trauma survivorship behind her that I'm not telling you anything that hasn't been publicly discussed, but you know, she was previously married and survived pretty severe domestic violence in her first marriage. And her journey in healing, you know, involved what you might expect, therapy and drugs and other things. And she was never really able to get to a really good, solid place of healing. And then she met Derek, and he got her into the outdoors, out fishing, out hunting, introduced her to the community of the Wild Sheep Foundation and other great, great hunting organizations. And it was through her journey with Derek in the outdoors and hunting that she finally started to achieve really great healing level for herself, a lot of peace. And so last year after her death, I really commend Derek. You know, I don't remember exactly the timing, but maybe about 6 months later or so, he reached out to Gray and I, and he asked us, he said, I have an idea of how I'd like to honor Ruby's memory and help other women who have survived traumas of some sort. And he said, I really want to help other women heal through hunting and activities in the outdoor, connection to nature, the way Ruby was able to achieve healing that way. And he said, you know, would the Wild Sheep Foundation and Women Hunt help me with that? And we said, you bet. And it's hard for me to talk about this. I'm going to try to keep my emotions buttoned down here. But so what Derek did was he, you know, he's a commercial fisherman in Alaska, and he also is an outfitter. And he donated a hunt that we put on auction Saturday night in January at this year's Sheep Show. And the buyer helped fund this Ruby Mayflower Blake Legacy Fund is what we call it. And the buyer of that auction item, the proceeds went to funding this fund. And then we also had people just come up and make cash donations to the fund as well. And Derek and I worked together here just in the last month to form a committee. And we're a committee of five, Derek and myself and three other women, Jana Waller, Brittany Boddington, and Julie McQueen. And those were women that Derek chose. And we're going to be working on a selection process of some sort that will allow us to choose women who we can then send on outdoor or hunting experiences and help them in their journeys. And we're really excited about this. We want to get our first women out this fall. And we're going to do this every year. We're going to raise money every year. And I forgot to mention that this fund is dedicated. So it is part of Women Hunt, but it's a subset and it's entirely protected. This fund is only for this very precise, you know, vision that Derek has to help trauma survivors. So we're really, really excited about that. And it ties into some feedback we've been getting in the last year or so from some of our members who are really pushing us to also develop components of wellness and well-being. So we're going to work on that too.
That's awesome. With the landscape and the perception, you know, generally speaking, right, broad stroking here of hunting, how do we, how do we get a story to the masses, if you will, the non-hunters or the people that, you know, are straddling the fence on whether they approve or disapprove? How do we get the story of healing, a Derek and Ruby story? How do we use that? Can we use things like that to show people how powerful what we do is and how, again, I said it earlier, how beautiful it is, right? If whatever that trauma looks like in someone's life and however they find through it, when you talk to the people that step outdoors, theirs is always, I found my healing here, right? Where you don't, I shouldn't say you don't, right? I'm generalizing again, but you don't hear that same, I found my healing. You still have the reference back to the trauma. And I think that the people you hear that step outside and hunt and fish and do those things, they actually stop mentioning the trauma part of it and have an outlook on things forward. So how do we get that story out? How do we use that to let people know that what we do isn't wrong, and this is the beauty in what we do?
Yeah, I know it's a great question, because I think we can all agree that, you know, we have great ways of getting our message out within our own communities. Yes. You know, there's great carbon TV, wild TV in Canada. You know, there's, you know, so much available to get our message out amongst ourselves.
Right.
It really is the key. And I don't know the answer. I wish I had the answer.
Right.
Because I mean, how to break that down to the average person.
Yeah. Because that's what you were up against, talking about the proof versus the hunting. We're always talking into a vacuum or yelling in the silo, right? That's a lot of what we do as hunters. Most of us want to be left alone and we want to go enjoy what we enjoy, right? But it's, to me, it's so important to, like, you know, get the message out there that this is what this community is. And I don't think we focus on community as much as we should, right? Yes, we'll go to the, you know, the rendezvous and the wild sheep show and Western Hunt Fest, right? Or Western Hunt Expo, things like that. But again, it's siloed. We're in the same silo all the time. It's like, let's figure out how we get this messaging across so we can have a bigger impact on the landscape and some of the information that's provided by the opposition, because that's emotionally tugged on, right? Everything you see that's misrepresentation of hunting is all emotionally charged. We have a problem with putting emotion into what we do when it comes to telling the story. We always refer to the wildlife, North American model of wildlife conservation. It falls on deaf ears. These are the stories that are so impactful and will, yeah, you know what I mean? Spread that message of hunters.
You know, and there, I think that's part of the key is, you know, we talked about it earlier, motivations, right? And stories are so important. So the more that we can get messaging across that's talking about those motivations and those personal touch point stories, the better. And, you know, there are people out there who are doing some great work to try to disseminate that, mm-hmm, for sure. And there's great material being produced. You know, I don't want to sound self-serving here, but I will mention, like, last year, Rebecca Peters was in our Women Hunt class of 2021. She lives in British Columbia. The Wild Sheep Society of British Columbia is the affiliate of the Wild Sheep Foundation found in that province. And she started a program of her own in BC under the Wild Sheep Society of BC called Women Shaping Conservation. And she's had a few small events and she's, you know, slowly building her program. And she had approached me, she and her husband Colin love hunting together. They're a really lucky couple. They like to hunt together. They hunt black bear a lot, both in the spring and the fall. She knows how much I love hunting bear as well, and the significance of bear hunting for me, mostly because of the impact that my first hunt had on me. And so she hosted me, because I'm a Canadian citizen. I'm also an American citizen. I hold dual citizenship. Because I'm a Canadian citizen, I can still hunt in British Columbia. Even though I'm not a resident anymore, I can still hunt there. If I don't need to go with an outfitter because I'm a citizen, I can go with another resident, right? So she approached me and said, what if I were to host you on a bear hunt? And why don't we use that experience as an opportunity to make a short film that where we can explore our motivations for hunting, you know, the Women Hunt program, Women Shaping Conservation. You know, for her, she saw a whole circle on giving back. And we explored a lot of films, themes in this film, you know, that closing the circle on giving back, the flipping the mentor-mentee role. You know, I went from mentor to mentee, you know, because I'm hunting her region, learning a new area, et cetera. You know, and then the ranges of emotion, how women sometimes process things differently. You know, it's not better, it's just different, you know, et cetera. And so we made a great film. It's called Beyond Bonds, A Women Hunt Story. It's on the Wild Sheep Foundation's YouTube channel. It's about 20 minutes long. It's a great film to watch. It explores a lot of those motivations and, you know, the stories, the feelings, and it presents it in a different way. A lot of the feedback we've been getting has said that, you know, love the emotion and seeing that the impact and the different, you know, it's just a different way of presenting hunting. And, but, you know, so I've just decided, I can't believe I forgot to even mention the film to you, but, you know, it's a, if you know, for people who might be interested in seeing a different type of hunting film, I, you know, watch it. It's a quick 20 minutes, you know, and, but, you know, when I think about the motivations and the stories, I think about guys like Robbie Kroger with Blood Origins. You know, he talks, you know, he does these great posts that really try to sort of focus on those stories. You know, he also does the conservation posts. You know, he has lots of different styles, but when he likes to promote those voices and those stories, he's not the only one. There's plenty of people who are doing it, right? And I think the key is having a tough skin when you put it out there. You know, you're going to get that bad feedback for sure. Criticism, haters, all of it. But the more you can push those stories out to the general public on platforms like that, as long as you can take the hits, you know, you're at least it's getting out there outside the non-traditional community.
Well, you know, what's funny about that is I think we'll take hits in the demographic with things that show the emotion, and we're not just showing that highlight reel, if you will, right? And that's so unfortunate that we take hits in our own demographic, right? And it's like, well, you're experiencing those things too. Maybe not that exact feeling. Maybe you experienced that 20 years ago, right? But it doesn't lessen the fact that you're having the same experience. And you said it earlier, right? There's jerks in everything, right?
Yeah.
But man, oh man, do we seem to come out in the woodwork when it comes to stuff like that.
I know. I sometimes, like in the fly fishing community, it's amazing sometimes, you know, somebody who's newer to fly fishing is excited and they post a picture and they've caught their first rainbow trout or something.
And they hold it wrong.
And they hold it wrong and people just attack them, yeah. Right? I'm like, oh my gosh, like, way to demoralize somebody who's excited and, you know.
but then, it turns people off to it, right? There's less community in that. But instead of doing that, why don't you educate a little bit, right? And you'll have, and it'll be 4 or 5 out of 100, right? Hey, look at this, you know, this greenhorn, or why are you holding the, it's like, come on, you guys. Come on, not everybody, you know, and who knows? I mean, maybe that in those waters they were fishing, they took it back to camp and, you know, threw it over the fire or something. I don't know. But I think it's hugely important for us to kind of shape that, the landscape of how we're viewed and putting those stories out there. And maybe that's cheap of me to say, you know, for the emotional tug, but that's what the opposition does, right? And the blatant lies they tell about what we do. And, you know, I mean, if you look at Colorado right now with the mountain lion or the cat ban, right? I mean, oh, that's just trophy hunting. No one eats mountain lion. It's like, no, that's not true, right? And if you look at the management strategy for mountain lion in Colorado, it's proven, right? So the fact that you're trying to take that away, it's emotionally tugged on. And the response that they, you know, with the misinformation, that was sort of like me struggling not to say safe space.
No.
But with the misinformation, it's emotionally tugged, right? So if we can present that as well, I think we would gain some ground with the people that are just misinformed or uninformed totally, right? And go, oh, wow, this is really what this is, right? And then there's something about seeing, forgive me, a middle-aged woman that decides that I'm going to endeavor down this path on my own and figure this out, and to see the light come on and to have such an impact across the board in conservation, other women's lives, right? To go from one to the opportunity to help thousands, and to take that message from thousands that you're helping to inform thousands or hundreds of thousands in telling the actual story beyond bonds, right? I think if we looked at it at large as a demographic through that lens and worked with intention and serious effort, the impact that we could have in our fights as hunters across the board it'd be a thousandfold if people got behind that. I got the chills.
I know. And you know, I want to highlight a couple others. Like, again, I'm not doing this to exclude anybody. There's lots of great people.
Absolutely.
Organizations, right? But there's some, there's some that stand out for me. And one is Conservation Visions, or the Wild, Conservation Visions has an initiative called the Wild Harvest Initiative. And Shane Mahoney runs that. And he has been spending years researching the most comprehensive data available on the consumption of wild game. And the data, and it's currently being released, or it will shortly be released, but I've seen subsets of it. But it's extraordinary. For people who like numbers, this is going to be invaluable in the discussion points around the value of harvesting wild game. Because as you and I both know, the majority of people who hunt to feed themselves. The majority do. And many, many Americans, it's the way they feed themselves. Mm. It's how they can afford to eat. It's not a joke, right? And so being able to illustrate the consumption of wild game tangibly, and he's been getting the data sets. I mean, it's impressive, from Indigenous, like First Nations groups, right? Not all of them provide the data, but some do. And also from our state and provincial and territorial agencies, when Hunter Report, right? So it's factually driven numbers about the number of hunters, the number of animals harvested, the numbers of pounds of meat that produces, and how many people it feeds. It's incredible. So just want to highlight the Wild Harvest Initiative and the great work they're doing. And we're going to see some significant data sets coming out of them. And then I think about great organizations. You're talking about what's going on in Colorado. It's happening in many different locations, the pressures that we're facing and this emotionally driven opposition to hunting. Howl.org is another great one for any hunter conservationist who wants to have their voice heard at the legislative level. Howl.org does a great job of letting you know where the hot button issues are, how to contact which legislators to get your voice heard. It's really, really important.
And it's one of the easiest platforms to get involved on, right? There's zero. And I just sat down with my buddies over there when we were at the Mile High Hunt and Fish Expo. It can't be any easier, right? If you want to be involved in something that costs you zero, right, but pays dividends, huge dividends, Howl is the easiest place to go, right? And the membership is free. They'll take donations, don't get me wrong, but the membership is free. You get on their website and you sign up for the membership, you get your alerts when those alerts come through. And I'm not a proponent necessarily of signing up for jumping on every action and just to jump on the action. I want to know what the action is. So I would really suggest that people read it as they get those actions, understand what they're signing, what that means. But it's so, so easy. I mean, it's literally 30 seconds of your life to get behind these efforts to keep, to keep us protected as hunters. And then just to drop back to Mr. Mahoney, Sheep Fever, episode 48, Gray just did a podcast with them. So that should give folks, Gray and Keith, should give folks some information on what Renee was just talking about. So suggest listening to that, and kind of understanding that would help with that.
Sure.
So message to the curious from the new hunter, right? What would be your message to folks, to women, not necessarily women, just anyone that is kind of looking at it going, man, I wonder if I should, it looks like a daunting, you know, undertaking. What is your message to them?
Oh, well, I would say, you know, if you are at all curious about hunting, and if you're thinking about it, or even just have questions, take that step, have confidence in yourself, and take the first step forward. The great thing about 2024 is that there's so many of us out there now that are so accessible and want to help, you know, so consider stepping outside of your comfort box and challenging yourself to do something uncomfortable or that maybe scares you. It's okay. There'll be people there that will want to help you. There's resources, and you know, you would be amazed at the caliber and quality of people that you're going to meet and how they can transform your lives if you're open to it.
And then finally, before we wrap this up, who's a better shot, you or Gray?
I knew it.
I don't know. Actually, he's a really great shot, but so am I. I'm not sure. We should have a competition.
Yeah. Yeah. Ooh. There it is right there. I got my, Gray. I'm going to have to put my money. I got $5 on Renee. $5 on Renee. I mean, generally speaking, women will outshoot us day in and day out. I mean, there is no ifs, ands, or buts about that. When we were in Raton, we had our novelty course set up and people were paying to shoot the novelty shots, but then asking Whitney, Wild Strength Podcast, to shoot for them. I mean, and she was dead ringing 12s like crazy, crazy, crazy. And I've seen women just plumb outshoot men day in and day out.
You know, go ahead, Guy.
After you.
I was just going to say, you know, I know what I said might sound a little bit like trite or whatever, but I really mean it because the transformations that I observe all the time, they're so life-changing. Mm-hmm. They're so empowering that when I say just take that step, I really mean it. You know, try to set aside your doubts and try to just take that leap of faith. I have a really good friend from Canada. She lives on Vancouver Island. I worked with her for a number of years. Her name is Wendy. And Gray and I went to the FTW ranch with Wendy and her husband, Tony, a number of years ago. Tony is retired Canadian military, and they really wanted to come to the ranch. And while Tony had experience with firearms, evidently, Wendy didn't. Limited, I think maybe shot a 22 a little bit when she was a kid or something like that. Anyway, she was in her 60s when she came to the ranch with us, and that would have been 2019. And she was in her 60s, and she was incredible. She was so good that the instructors started calling her Deadeye. And, you know, it was like an amazing moment for me as her friend to see her confidence just absolutely
blossom.
Soar. It just, yeah, you know, she was so nervous going in. She was really afraid she wouldn't be able to perform well. She had all these self-doubts and insecurities. She did what every good student should do. She listened to her instructors. She followed the instruction and she was crack shot of the course and ended up being called Deadeye. And it just transformed her, you know? Heck and yeah. So I'm like, if my 60 some year old friend Wendy can do it, anybody can.
I mean, and there's something to be said there. And I said it, so I'm going to qualify it a little bit, but there's something to be said with women behind the string or the trigger is I don't think women harp on the last shot, good or bad, like men do. I think we hold on to that last screw up, right? This wasn't the perfect shot. So it's in our head. And I've seen it. I've watched DR Long Range Concepts. My buddy Ron White, we go to long range school. It's been 2 years ago now. And I'm watching the boys screw up. And Carrie was the only woman there. And she was able to just ping after ping after ping. If there was an error, the correction of error, the understanding that it was just a mistake, and then just lay back down in the scope. And it's like, why can't we do that? And I think it's because we will think about the last shot over and over and over, and it haunts us through you know, that three rounds or four rounds or, you know, 700 yards, 900 yards, whatever it is. And I think that's where the difference is I think you guys can just wipe it away where we just sit there and dwell on it. Don't want to look. Yeah. I've seen it. Yeah, no, I've seen it time and time again. And it used to be pure speculation, but I've even watched my wife do it with, you know, just getting her behind the bow in the last year. And we'll go to the range together and I'll screw up a shot and it's a ringer for me. And I'm like, what did I do? So, you know, I'm talking myself through her anchor. I'll watch her send one, you know, up the hill to where I got to go hunt for the arrow for 10 minutes. And then boom, boom. I mean, her group is half inch group. She's already forgot about it. Oh, I messed up. Okay. This is what I got to do. Boom. It's there. And I've really tried to learn from that in what, you know, I do. I mean, you saw me shoot a little bit. I'm not horrible behind the bow by any stretch of the imagination, but I could always be better, right? And I just watch her clean it up faster than I can. And I've been shooting, I don't even know how many years now, since my early 20s. So I've noticed it, and it just now with her again, it just stands out even more that she just wipes it away and goes to the next one. So I wanted to talk about a little bit about the partnership between Wild Sheep Foundation, Women Hunt, and Western Hunt Fest, because that's really what spawned what I'm going to call, and maybe you see it different, as our friendship.
Yes.
What did that look like? What was the decision for you guys, and why was that important to be involved?
Oh, well, thanks. And, you know, I want to take this opportunity to do a little bit of a shout out. You know, it was the Women Hunt program that brought us together. April Elwell from our class of 2021, who lives in Reno, Nevada. Her husband is on the board of directors for Silver Arrow Bowman in Reno. And I understand you guys are all going to be down there at their facility in a later part of May, I think, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And so, you know, it was April who reached out to me and said, Teddy's involved with these guys and they want to have more of a women's presence. And I thought maybe I could man a Women Hunt booth at the Reno event. And it really started as simply as that and led to, of course, me having that call with the three of you to talk about it. And, you know, I was able to brief Gray, and Gray just wanted to talk to you guys so badly to hear more about your vision, your motivations, what you guys were about, what your event is about. And we went from the possibility of Women Hunt having a booth in Reno to becoming title sponsors. And, you know, I know for myself, when I spoke with you guys, and we talked about this, you know, with Gray on that call too, where the three of you and Western Hunt Fest have similar motivations to the Wild Sheep Foundation and the Women Hunt program. You know, we are coming from the same place. Our motivations are the same or very similar, at least. And not all organizations have those symmetries, right? So when you find like-minded people whose purpose and reasons are coming from the same areas, it feels good to connect and with them, right? And we love how Western Hunt Fest focuses on the mountain hunting aspect. You know, you introduce the pack out challenge, the sprint challenge, your courses have challenging terrain aspects to it that are geared to the mountain hunter. And even if you're not a mountain hunter, you train this way, you're going to benefit, right? But, you know, I love the fact that what you and Jeff and Efren shared with me on our first call, when you talked about some of the feedback you got last year from the women who were showing up and saying, why don't you have things for women's events or more women's events or more opportunities or more presence for women, however it was framed to you. I really respected the fact that you guys listened to that feedback and said, yeah, we want to step up. We want to do more. And considering how grassroots Women Hunt is, you know, from a founder who was a nobody from Alberta to, you know, us to today, I love the fact that, you know, that for me, there's a connection there as well. So that's some of the reasons why. Yeah. I decided Women Hunt would be perfectly placed to be title sponsor of your women's events.
Yeah, no, we were absolutely honored to even have that conversation, right? And it just seemed, like you said, it just seemed like it fit. And then for me, like talking to Gray, right? He seems, and this is my limited exposure, he is a man of action, which I absolutely appreciate, right? He's to the point, straightforward, honest, and seems to be, you know, full of integrity. And it was like, this is not this can't be anything but a good decision to take on this partnership. So we were absolutely honored for it. And how cool is that, right? And it's such a, I'm going to say it's such an anomaly, right? I mean, I got points like you wouldn't believe for sheep. I've never been on a sheep hunt. All three of us, Jeff, E, and I, we consider ourselves elk guys, right? But it was, everything just clicked, right? Everything just clicked on the phone call. And then when you and I met, it seemed to click even more. Again, my opinion. But it was like, yeah, this was just a great decision. And what an opportunity, right, to help grow Women Hunt in whatever way, shape, or form we can. And maybe we find that next one of 12 that goes and takes the program on, right? I mean, I believe, you know, you and Ashley down at the Whittington Center had a conversation, right? Maybe that's something she takes on, you know? And it just, when you can see the growth and you can, of the growth of our demographic and people that are interested and curious, and to see them be able to get out and put that pack on for the first time or pull that bow back for the first time, just amazing. So it's an absolute honor to have you guys partnered up with us.
Thank you. And it's an honor for me too. And, you know, I was able to go to your first event of the year in Raton at the Whittington Center a few weeks ago. And, you know, it was a great event. I was just thrilled to see, I was thrilled to meet all of you in person, you know, and connect with each of you. And you're all so great. And you're all the shooters who came out and all the people that came with them. The community was wonderful. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody there was just fantastic, kind, welcoming, you know, and interesting. And I wish I could go to every event this year. I can't, but we'll have reps at everyone, and I'm glad for that.
Yeah, I can't wait to shake everybody's hands and kind of hear their stories, and that part of it is super fun. What did you think? I mean, it's a different type of community, right? I mean, you're talking, generally speaking, elk hunters or mule deer hunters at that event, right? And you've been pretty in-depth across the board, but you get a lot of exposure to Wild Sheep Foundation. And sheep hunters are, in my opinion, like elk hunters. The specificity is there, but they are so diehard in what they do, they don't really cross lines until they, you know, maybe hit all those goals that they had, you know, in the species. So what do you think, what was the, oh, okay, I get it moment, maybe?
Well, I think I, like, as much as you guys had explained the courses, I didn't really get the courses mm-hmm. until I was able to walk the first one, right? And so for me, because I'm not an archery hunter, yeah. I only rifle, right? So for me, the aha moment was when I walked that course for the first time. Devin and I went together and we followed a group of guys, really nice group of four guys, and watched them shoot all the targets or most of them. And that was really my aha moment. But then I had a second one, and it was your pack out challenge. Like, when I saw that, the way you guys structure it and the intensity of the people who choose to do it and their determination, like, that was my second one. I was like, that is the best. And then your sprint challenge was super interesting. You know, I don't know. There were lots of hits for me because it's a untraditional community for me to be exposed to. Right. So there were lots of firsts for me, and I just loved it. It was great.
For me, watching you as we were doing the elk calling competition was, for me, that was the best, because I'm watching you and I know that you don't know what's going on, right? And you don't know the nuances of the calls, but to kind of see the light bulb flicker in, like, okay, this is pretty interesting. It was super cool to kind of see that and you know, your intrigue, if you will, as you were watching it.
Yeah. Well, it was really fun to watch somebody who's so skilled at it, hey, you know, at doing the seminar. And then your competition was great. And I really love how family friendly your event is. That was really lovely to see. Lots of kids, and you guys are just great with all of them. You know, having the kids elk calling competition was absolutely precious. Yeah. Like, yeah. So, yeah.
I mean, if we don't fuel that now, we are all in trouble, right?
Right. Yeah. And, I know that lots of men do great work bringing youth along, right? But there is something about women, you know, mothers bring their kids,
mm-hmm.
whatever it is that they're doing, their kids come along, you know? So it's all one big symbiotic, you know, family. And it's one of the reasons why I really believe the community should be enthusiastic about bringing more women in.
Absolutely.
You bring the women, they bring the kids. Yep. It's just a natural progression, right? And, you know, I wanted to also say, if it's okay, I'm going to kind of segue a little bit back when we were talking about advocacy, like with Wild Harvest Initiative and Howl, and et cetera. The other thing too, that's, I think, you know, really critically important about bringing women into the field is that if you get women's voices behind those votes too, the more women voters you have who understand the issues around the special ballot initiatives that are coming up constantly by the opposition, you know, the more women you have showing up at the ballot box who understand the issue and know that if I vote yes or no on whatever the issue is, I can positively impact my ability to hunt and provide food for my family, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, people underestimate the importance of the vote mm-hmm. and those legislative actions. So, you know, another great reason for bringing women in. Sorry, I'm
That's, I'm glad you said it, because, right, it's hugely important on both fronts, right? If mom's there, the family's there. And then, I mean, there's a lot to be said about mom getting out to the ballot box and influencing the kids to get out to the ballot box and their understanding of that, right? I mean, it's huge, huge, huge. And I think we neglect that a little bit too in conversation. So how can people connect with Women Hunt? If they have questions, can they get a hold of you? Who do they get a hold of, et cetera, et cetera?
You bet. So like I said, we have that website that you're going to put the link into the notes, right?
Yes,
okay,
ma'am.
Perfect. It's a little bit long. So that's a way to connect with us as far as seeing a little bit about our program and that application process, some of the testimonials of some of the participants who've gone through. And like I said, we're going to expand that. Also, we have it presence on Instagram. It's at Women Hunt, Facebook at Women Hunt. And we have a YouTube channel, though not a lot of content there yet, but we have a YouTube channel as well at Women Hunt. And then our email address is Women Hunt. So that is that's plural, WOMEN Hunt at wildsheepfoundation.org. And people can email me anytime at that email address. And those are the different ways you can connect with us. We have like a really, I'm going to say, quite a robust community on Instagram. And we have a great social media manager who manages most of our content for us. But, you know, people look at comments and questions too. So if people, you know, are more comfortable doing it through Instagram, you can communicate with us that way as well.
Cool. Well, my friend, I appreciate the time. It's biased, but it was a great conversation. And I look forward to seeing you. Are you making Palisades?
I can't hit Palisade.
Ah, dang it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I will see you in Reno then.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, thank you greatly. And look forward to the next time we're able to get together.
Yeah. Thank you, guys. I appreciate it very much.